This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, June 26th, the Deposed Scumbags edition. I'm June Thomas, editor of Outward Slate's LGBTQ section. Hannah Rosen is becoming just a faint memory, but she will be back on the podcast in late July. But until then, the XX Gabfest will be a New York affair. I'm here in our swank West Village studio with Slate senior editor Jessica Winter. Hi, Jessica.
Hello, June.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hello, Noreen.
Hi.
Noreen has been such a millennial. She's looking at her phone right now.
I'm pulling up my notes.
Sure,
I
sure.
Don't, what's this pen and paper you have in front of you?
Before we get started, I just want to remind listeners about our email address where you can send comments, questions, and expressions of appreciation and outrage. That address is xxgabfest@slate.com. I don't have much to share from you from my last rummaging through the mailbag because, for the most part, it was a symphony of praise, which... if I repeated it, would just make us sound big-headed. So in future, please tell us how you really feel, won't you? And if you ever need more information about the stories that we discuss on the podcast, as well as our recommendations, you can find more information on our show page, slate.com/XX. Thanks again to everyone who wrote in. Please do let us know what you think of the show at xxgabfest@slate.com. Okay, our three topics for today are the scuzzball in winter, that is, the apparent descent of Dov Charney and Terry Richardson, also Lana Del Rey, her new record and her recent cry for help, and finally, we'll talk with BuzzFeed executive editor Doree Shafira about her recent story about how she almost froze her eggs. Our first topic... Dov Charney, the founder of leggings and t-shirt emporium American Apparel, was fired as CEO last week, in the words of the New York Times, because an internal investigation found that he had misused company money and had allowed an employee to post naked photographs of a former female employee who had sued him, according to a person with knowledge of the investigation. That's also clear. Meanwhile, in the last few months, former models and potential models have accused skeevy fashion and celebrity photographer Terry Richardson of gross sexual behaviour. Noreen, when we were planning out our topics for this week, you called these guys the creepy deposed kings of hipster culture. What's going on? Are slimy, rich and powerful tastemakers getting their comeuppance?
Well, I think this was just an instance where... the news sort of worked in our favor in terms of tying these two guys together. New York Magazine, where I work, did a big cover story on Terry Richardson that had been months in the works. I mean, the models have been accusing him of sexual
impropriety,
let's call it that. There are other things you could call it, I guess, for years
Indeed.
And years now, actually. But it just happened to come out the week before the Dov Charney news. I mean, no one has thought these guys were wholesome ever. That was sort of their thing.
Right.
But it does feel like the end of an era in some weird way, that these guys who, you know, for, you know, 6 and 8 and 10 years have been sort of out there, like, as these, with these retro 70s kind of vibes where they're just like making porny things seem cool, and then all of a sudden they really don't seem cool, like, in any way. Like, I don't know anyone who's like Dov Charney, like, really want to dress like that guy. Like, Terry Richardson, like, got his book on my coffee table, you know. They just they just feel out of, in addition to, you know, all of the truly awful things that they have been accused of, they just feel out of the moment.
Well, it's funny that both of them almost seem to include, you know, very large payouts, settling potential lawsuits, settling claims, almost as part of the cost of doing business. American Apparel couldn't get loans because of Charney, and more publications have sworn off working with Richardson. Does that mean that the free market works, Jessica?
I think it definitely works in the case of Dove Charney. I was really surprised that this happened. His board is handpicked.
Right.
You know, he chose his own board. And the Jane profile, the Jane magazine profile of him that really started the drumbeat of, whoa, this guy is unusually scummy. That's 10 years old now, the profile in which he masturbated in front of a reporter repeatedly, not just once. The sexual harassment suits and litigation date back at least to 2006 that we know about. And I think in this case, the sexual improprieties that he's been accused of over and over and over again have been linked inextricably to American Apparel's own financial woes. I mean, there's the fact that American Apparel has lost these opportunities with potential investors and partners because of Charney's reputation. There's also the severance packages and the settlements and the litigation and any number of legal fees that they've incurred. I mean, American Apparel has just been hemorrhaging money since 2009, and everyone was hemorrhaging money in 2009, but they've never recovered the way so many other brands have. So I think in this case, it would have been great if someone along the way had said, hey, we're the board and we don't want this guy around because he's a scumbag, but his identity as a scumbag has become inextricable from his identity as just a bad captain of this particular ship.
But isn't the scumbagness part of what American Apparel is selling and part of what Terry Richardson is selling? That's sort of what unites them, right? Like, when you go into American Apparel, it's like those infamous pictures of the models sort of, you know, the clothes are beside the point, which actually is kind of the point of American Apparel. Clothes are very, very simple and very body conscious usually. And so that, you know, okay, so he's this over-sexualized, creepy guy, but like, the whole vibe is over-sexualized, and that's part of it. Just for a while, it worked as branding, and then it didn't. Like, it just was too real. You know, it was not a commercial where there's a creepy guy kind of looking girls up and down and doing whatever. It was like real life where there was a creepy guy looking girls up and down and doing whatever.
And all of it seems to stem from this very early to mid-90s place. I mean, both Terry Richardson and Dove Charney are straight out of the 70s. Their aesthetic, their glasses, their mutton chops and mustache, they're straight out of the 70s. And then their aesthetic is straight out of 1995. Those Calvin Klein commercials where the kind of pubescent-looking, very skinny models in jeans and underwear are being questioned uncomfortably by a kind of gruff, adversarial off-screen voice, and it all looks kind of vaguely non-consensual. And that whole creepy vibe is straight out of 20 years ago. So when we talk about these two guys as heroes of current hipster culture, it's very strange because they seem both 20 years and 40 years removed from what we're assuming is happening now.
I think we'll be coming to that very discussion a little bit later, because that also seems to me, at least as an outsider, to be Lana Del Rey's MO.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But it was very striking in Ben Wallace's New York profile of Terry Richardson when he described Richardson's books, which I guess are, you know, a big part of his oeuvre. They were really disgusting
love
things.
Love how you say herb.
Herb. It should be like an old guy's name, but anyway. The things that were in his books just sounded absolutely disgusting. Too disgusting, actually, for me to repeat. And I'm from England. You know what I mean? Like, I grew up with dirty things, and I think they're funny, but...
Wait, is England particularly pervy as a nation?
Not so much pervy, but like, it's dirty like... postcards, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Kind of Benny Hill kind
of
things.
Said the vicar to the, yeah, you know.
The vicar and the tutu.
Yeah.
Okay. Said the bishop to the, actress to the bishop. But
in America, it's very simple. That's what she said. It's very easy to remember.
It's just like gross, gross stuff. And that is what has made his reputation. And he has been doing this, you know, it's kind of, and also just, it's like, it's not just his brand, but it's also his kind of methodology of taking photos. You know, he kind of described how he started just sort of pointing a camera and a flash at girls leaning against a wall, and that essentially that's really still how he works. And therefore, that kind of puts him in a small room, well, let's go back to my place kind of thing. And it's not in any way to excuse or to just explain why the hell he keeps getting to be able to do this. But it's like his entire brand, his entire method is all about his skeeziness and his kind of revulsion. And it's made him. And so now I suppose it's appropriate that it also ends him.
Well, the thing about that profile was that he came across as so unreflective in it, I thought. He couldn't even really talk about him. You know, he was the high art world, really, you know, maybe more the high fashion world. I'm not knowledgeable enough about either to make the proper distinction here, but he was, you know, a critical darling, let's say, and he got certainly lots of high-paying commercial work and a lot of, you know, very big gallery shows. But he himself doesn't seem to have given, or at least was not able to articulate, an intellectual underpinning to the work that he was doing that was sort of celebrated as transgressive in this way. That to me was I mean, there are certainly the sexual allegations are incredibly damning, but that also I felt like was damning in some way in that article that people didn't really pick up. I mean, people were very angry about the article because people accused it of being too even-handed, which I'm curious what you guys thought of the piece and the discussion around it. You know, like I found it illuminating to find out that he had. And again, I'm in the tank. I work there, whatever. But, but you know, he had this father who had a career also as a high fashion photographer who sounds like very skeevy himself, would, you know, end up having sex with a lot of the models and, you know, left his mom for Angelica Houston. Like there was, and he, Terry Richardson, seems very hung up on his dad and has all these like weird, creepy, like childhood motifs in his work. And I thought that was all okay. Like he's done some bad things. Let's hear about what brought him to that place. And I thought that was worth doing. But a lot of people online seem to think that was not worth doing, that if you even spoke to him or, you know, spoke to him without saying, like, at the end of every sentence that he was quoted in, like, and he's a bad man, that it was not the right way to handle it. And I'm curious if you had that reaction to the piece, too.
I was aware of the criticisms of the piece before I actually read it. And when I sat down to read the piece, I really appreciated how matter-of-fact the piece was about laying out what his aesthetic is, what his approach is, how he works with different models and subjects, his family background. I mean, I knew enough about Terry Richardson to know the kind of aura of sleaze and venereal disease that kind of, you know, wafts around him. So I came to it with that context, and it was actually refreshing to me that someone was being so even-handed about it. While at the same time, in the last maybe third of the piece, it does go in pretty deep, talking about people who have objected to his tactics, who have felt coerced, or who have just felt uncomfortable and full of regret about their participation in his shoots. So I appreciated that. I think his lack of reflectiveness isn't actually all that unusual among the, you know, art fashion world. I mean, if you've ever read an interview with Jeff Koons, who's being feted at the Whitney right this moment, I mean, a lot of these guys, and I'm not going to put Terry Richardson into any kind of high art pantheon or even medium art pantheon, because he really does just line people up against a wall and, you know, aim a flash in their general direction. And most of the creativity goes into like how they're, you know, twisting his penis, you know, what direction they might be twisting it. But I think a lot of people who make really interesting art don't necessarily know what they're doing when they make it. Mm-hmm. And the art is actually smarter and more articulate than they are. Mm-hmm. So that didn't catch me out. And the matter-of-factness and even-handedness of the profile, I think, was actually totally in its favor and made it better.
Yeah, I also thought that it allowed you to see the culture of enabling around him in
yes,
a way that
absolutely.
You
absolutely
have.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, people were mad that it quoted, like, who was it, Gavin McGinnis or Shane Smith, one of the Vice guys. It quoted some of his sort
I think
of
it was
like
Gavin McGinnis. Yeah,
yeah, some of his sort of downtown friends, you know, being like, Terry's great. Just you could see, you got a picture of the world around him, how insulated he was from thinking that there could be anything bad about like pulling down his pants and asking a model to give him a blowjob. Like, and also one thing that an anonymous source in this piece said that I think also applies to Dov Charney, you know, he wasn't, speaking of Terry Richardson, this person said he wasn't asking this of Kate Moss or so, you know, when he was doing an ad campaign for H&M, he didn't ask those girls to do it. It was the girls who just kind of like were fresh off the boat from, you know, Iowa or wherever. They wanted to make it as a model. They somehow are in Terry Richardson's studio. The power imbalance is like, you know, massive there. They want to do anything to make it. And those are the girls he's asking to do something inappropriate. So he's not, he's canny enough to know when he can do it and not do it. And I thought that was the most sort of damning thing. I mean, a lot of the accusations with Dov Charney are like with women who work in his stores. It's the same thing. It's when, you know, that's the creepiest part about it is that it's, you know, it's controlled and very aware.
And it was, it's interesting with Richardson that, that because there have been so many pretty well written often sort of pieces, firsthand, first person experiences of, you know, being, you know, having his penis, you know, put in their mouth or whatever, it, when they're testing out to be a model or they're in his studio by very sort of self-aware people who can, you know, put together a good string of sentences, which makes me think that he is doing it every night and that, you know, if maybe 5 or 10 of them over all these years have been women who had the wherewithal, the contacts, the, you know, ability with pros to write these kinds of things, just imagine how many other women he's done it to who didn't and, you know, didn't have access, have that kind of access. I mean, and to me, what was most striking and just kind of made me feel a little bad for him, which I guess is not a good thing, but was how stuck he is. I mean, they made a, you know, obviously he has made a feature of the fact that he doesn't change, that he wears the same clothes, that he does the same pose, that he, you know, eats the same food. Mm-hmm. And just like, to me, that just made me want to, you know, dude, get help. It just struck me that people in the art world do get very stuck. And he, you know, his stuckness is has, his bug has become his feature. And that is kind of sad. And he really needs to get help.
Well, he has, the article says he's in a lot of therapy. He has a history of addiction. He soul cycles religiously. So there's that.
If 2013 was indeed the year of peak Richardson, if he is now on a downward slope, and I don't know that he is, he could recover from this. It's, if you care about Terry Richardson as an artist, and I certainly do not, but it's kind of sad because he has been stuck for so long and he has been doing the same stuff for so long. Of course, he also directed the Beyoncé video XO, and that is such an exuberant, lovely video. She's in Coney Island. She has all her clothes on. She's, you know, she's on a roller coaster, and that is such a fun video. It is so life affirming. It's just lovely. It's so un-Terry Richardson. And, you know, Beyoncé can make an amazing video with anybody. She doesn't need Terry Richardson to do that. But it did seem like he was entering a different place there. And, you know, it would have been nice to see him continue toward that.
I would just say, Jessica, that a stuck clock is right twice a day.
That's an excellent point.
Okay, moving on. Lana Del Rey has a new album called Ultraviolence, and as she's promoting it, she's doing the thing she apparently does best, which is upset people by saying shocking things and making people feel superior and haughty. Noreen and Jessica, I'm going to be leaning on you heavily in this segment because when I tried to watch her videos and listen to her music, I just wanted to hit stop. Not because it was awful, though it wasn't great to my ears, but just because the videos were too long. They're like, they go on and on and on. I thought you guys had small attention spans. And the music was very repetitive and the images were so oddly dated. I really need you to explain her to me. She's clearly big on the Kennedys and with the album's title, Clockwork Orange, which looms large over me because the film was banned in England when I was a gal. And so it seems just the most shocking thing. But it also seems like a really odd reference point for someone in her 20s. Jessica, who is Lana Del Rey and is she a feminist icon?
Lana Del Rey is not a feminist icon. She actually has said that the concept of feminism is boring.
Boring.
So just a really quick recap of Lana Del Rey. She kind of appeared out of nowhere in the summer of 2011. She supposedly self-posted a self-made video for her song Video Games to YouTube, which had all these kind of vintage Polaroid-y clips and also some footage of Paz de la Huerta falling down outside a club. It's unclear to me whether she was signed to a label or not at that point and how much of this was really someone in their bedroom creating something out of nothing and how much of it was manufactured. But it doesn't really matter because she is a completely manufactured icon. It is all artifice. It is all invention. That's the whole point of Lana Del Rey. She had a few very well-received singles. She was a total internet phenomenon. And before her first record, Born to Die, was even released, she appeared on Saturday Night Live. Now, the entire internet, such as it is, however we're defining that, knew who she was and was obsessed with her at that point. But when she came on Saturday Night Live, the typical viewer of Saturday Night Live had no idea who this person was. This beautiful, redheaded young woman in this white gown. And she was terrible. She performed video games in blue jeans and she just stank up the joint. She you know, her lower tones had this kind of Cookie Monster thing going on. When she belted, she sort of sounded like she was trying to do a Kate Smith kind of thing. She didn't know what to do with her hands. It was, you know, it was not Ashley Simpson levels of bad, but it was bad. But she recovered. She had a song in the Great Gatsby soundtrack. There was an EDM remix of one of her songs that totally blew up. And she has become something of a pop slash rock star. Her thing, her aura is of a kind of bruised starlet, David Lynch kind of chanteuse, like Julie Cruz and Laura Palmer combined. You know, the sad, haunted singer in front of a red curtain. That is her thing. And it's really captivated a lot of people, and it's really angered and bored a lot of people. But everyone needs a divisive pop star or three or ten in their lives, and she's one of them.
And the other layer with her manufacturedness that is part of the reason there was so much internet talk about her is that she, it came out, has a well-connected father and had, before she was Lana Del Rey, she was Lizzie Grant, and she had noticeably smaller lips and a very different vibe and had put out an album. And this made a lot of the sort of pitchfork listening crowd of, I think, largely men feel sort of betrayed that she'd like created this like hipster vision that they were all like completely snookered by at first. And then they discovered like, oh, she's just a manufactured pop star like the rest of them.
But manufactured pop star is such a raucous old school. And
also redundant.
I know. Right. I know.
There's so many natural pop stars. They just suddenly show up on Saturday Night Live.
Well, Molly Lambert, who Jessica referred to as, I think, the poet laureate of Lana Del Rey.
Yes, absolutely.
Lindsay
Zolads,
is that how you say it?
Have
both written, I think, really thoughtful things about Lana Del Rey. My impression is that Molly likes her and Lindsay does not, but they both like sort of defend her as a non-exuberant pop star and like want there to be more space for sort of, I think languor is the word that one of them used, for a, you know, a woman to be singing not about empowerment, you know, sort of in the era, speaking of EXO and Beyonce and Girls Who Rule the World, you know, that just is sort of the default thing. And they want there to be more room for sadness and pop that isn't, you know, sort of dressed up with an awesome beat as like, you know, I think I recommended Sia's Chandelier on here, you know, a few weeks ago, which is a very tragic song, but it's like an amazing, you know, sort of lifts you along with its pop hooks, whereas Lana Del Rey is just kind of like wallow in it. And now she's become controversial for saying, you know, and whether this is true or not, she has said that she actually does want to die.
No, she actually said that. She was interviewed by The Guardian, and she was talking about different pop stars that she loves, including Amy Winehouse and Kurt Cobain. And the interviewer notes that the people that she's rattling off all died young. And the interviewer, and I thought this was a really stupid question, and she gave admittedly a stupid answer, so just everyone all around wasn't on their game. But he said, you know, is dying young something that you think about? Is it something that, you know, appeals to you on some level? And she said, yeah, I wish I was already dead, which is kind of an amazing thing to say. There's a lot of different ways to answer that question. And Frances Bean Cobain, Kurt Cobain's daughter, went on Twitter to say, hey, you don't actually mean that. Don't say that. I never knew my dad. Please don't say stupid shit like that. And so she didn't say that, she can't say that she was misquoted because the recording is up on the Guardian site, but she has said that she felt manipulated, that he was asking her leading questions. But that kind of statement is part of her whole her vibe of doom and nihilism and sadness that permeates, or that she wants to permeate her music. I don't really hear that as much. I mean, she did write an album called Born to Die, right, and release a single called Born to Die. But what I hear when I listen to Lana Del Rey is this kind of, like, it's this faint debasement, but it's mostly just post-coital exhaustion. That's the languor in it. And it goes along with her whole casting couch by day, biker gang by night persona. And I'm being very clear here, her persona, I know nothing about her as a person. But it's that kind of compulsive seeking of pleasure, compulsive seeking out of bad guys, guys who are wrong for her, and then sort of this compulsive exhaustion that goes along with that sex and drugs lifestyle. That's what I hear. I don't hear real sadness or despair or longing in her music. And I don't know whether that's a flaw or not.
Lindsay Zolads in Pitchfork described her music as sounding like a faked orgasm, which I thought was a very funny description and gets to your post-coital exhaustion.
So you guys, I know you did send me some links earlier, which I kind of clicked off after a minute or so, but if you were going to sort of give me a song that is the Lana Del Rey, if there is such a thing, what would you recommend that a person listen to? And we can listen to a little bit of it here.
Actually, we should listen to a clip from one of the songs from Ultraviolence. It's called West Coast.
Is called Ultraviolence, which to me sounds like a reference to Clockwork Orange, which is a book from what, the 60s. It's, when you look at her videos, they're full of Kennedys or faux Kennedys or Kennedy references. Just her look is, she looks like actually Don Draper's wife Megan in Mad Men on Good Days. I mean,
and another great Molly Lambert line is that Ultraviolence sounds like it was recorded from Megan Draper's Laurel Canyon hilltop abode.
Right. And so can anybody explain to me just why she's so drawn to this era that was long before she was born? I mean, I understand that we've all, you know, people now are inspired by Victorian novelists. I mean, I understand all that, but it just, I don't understand how a hipster is drawn to that stuff. I mean, can you, you know, give me, you know, back reference 101?
Well, why wouldn't a hipster be drawn to that stuff? It's, I mean, also the term hipster
she's,
you know,
hardly,
a complicated
right.
one.
No doubt, yeah.
But I think people are often fascinated, you know, she, especially if you're someone who is almost putting on a costume, it's easier to go to an earlier era where the costumes are more interesting and more distinctive, maybe.
And we know from the Oscars that costumes that are somewhat vintage are more likely to win prizes. Ergo, maybe also to provoke.
I can't speak to her specific 60s obsession, but I think she is obsessed with seeming out of time. I mean, even right down to the production on Ultraviolence, it is so heavy on reverb. It just sounds like it's far away in space and time. There's just a very studied remoteness about her that I think is very important to what she's trying to do. And the David Lynch obsession, too. I mean, David Lynch's movies, his characters, you can never quite place them mm-hmm. in time. Mm-hmm. His movies never feel like they were part of some trend, like Blue Velvet was not such a 1986 kind of movie. Mulholland Drive did not feel like the movie you had to see in 2001. They just sort of drift untethered in this really beautiful and compelling way. And I do not feel that Lana Del Rey the way I feel about David Lynch, like, is just no comparison. But I think that timelessness is what she's going for.
I was listening to the new album as I was getting dressed this morning and sort of like doing my morning things, and I just wanted to go back to bed and like pull the covers over my head. It was really not good morning music. So if you try out some Lana Del Rey, do it, you know, at a time when you do not have to be on the train early.
I think when she said I wish I was dead, she really meant I wish I was asleep.
Yeah, it's a very hungover sounding album. It's yeah. the sound of a Saturday morning in Williamsburg in 2014.
Maybe. Not timeless at all.
No.
All right, enough about Lana Del Rey. But before we move on to our final topic, we'd like to take this opportunity to remind podcast listeners that Slate recently launched a membership program, Slate Plus. For $5 a month or $50 a year, you can show your love and appreciation for Slate and get access to special features. You will find ad-free podcasts, special podcasts like a wonderful series in which Willa Paskin is talking to various experts and generally fabulous people about the show Orange is the New Black. And there's all kinds of behind-the-scenes stuff. It's like we've lifted the curtain and allowed you Slate Plus members to see how we make the Slate sausage, so to speak. If you'd like to check it out, please go to slate.com/XXplus. And if you use that URL, the powers that be will know you support the XX Gabfest. So for our final topic today, we're going to talk with BuzzFeed's Dori Shaffer about a great piece she published on BuzzFeed this weekend. As they so often do at that site, the Head and Deck does a great job of summarizing the piece. "I was sure freezing my eggs would solve everything," it begins. "When I was 35 and single in New York City, I was convinced I'd be alone forever. Undergoing a costly procedure to buy myself time seemed like the right choice." Dori, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You are calling too from Los Angeles, so we're very grateful for that. I really enjoyed the piece. It's written with this lovely immediacy and honesty. And for those listeners who haven't read it yet, maybe you can share a little of what it was that made you contemplate egg harvesting.
Sure. Well, like I said in the piece, I broke up with someone and a couple months later turned 35. And the confluence of those two events seemed to send me into some sort of terrible spiral of depression where I just felt, oh, my God, I'm alone. Dating in New York is terrible. I better do something about this, or, you know, I'm going to be alone forever, and I need to buy myself some time. It was a dark time, and so I started kind of exploring these options after I read this. I think I read an article on CNN.com that was like, freezing your eggs is the best thing to happen to women in their 30s, and you must do it. I'm exaggerating slightly, but like they really sold it like this kind of magical solution, and that if you didn't do it, you were like a fool. So I started looking into options, and I made an appointment at the clinic that I think they actually referenced in the story to find out what it was all about. So that's kind of the backstory.
But harvesting eggs is a incredibly invasive and or just kind of, it messes with your body a lot because you have to sort of stimulate them before they can be harvested. I mean, you go into some detail about just the kind of the medical regimen that mm-hmm. was, and also the expense. And I just sort of, it almost seemed like the expense was, you know, it was one thing, not that it was easy, but, you know, you could figure that out. You could find a way to, you know, the $15,000 and then $2,000 a year to keep them frozen, which seems like the mm-hmm. most expensive cold storage in the world. But the sort of the medical side of things seems like it was much more difficult to kind of, you know, just come to terms with, and because of just the level of complication, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to overstate it, and I think women who have frozen their eggs actually do have different experiences, and they say that in the orientation. They say, you know, some people have no complications, but that a lot of people feel X, Y, and Z, and it was, you know, you're basically shoving a ton of hormones in your body for 2 weeks, which, like, also isn't great for you. And there haven't really been any studies about what doing that to your body does, by the way. And you like can't exercise, you can't drink, you can't, you know, you get very emotional, and I'm already on, you know, I'm already like an emotional person. it wouldn't have been forever, but I was just like, oh, this is just not like, this is not awesome.
And yet it was kind of appealing because of the control it offered, right? And it just
got rid of some
anxiety.
Totally. And, you know, I thought, okay, I'll do this, and then that will relieve all of this anxiety that I'm feeling. It will be this instant solution. I won't feel stressed anymore about dating. You know, it'll just take this huge, huge weight off my shoulders. And I thought that until I actually started talking to the doctor, when he said, well, you know, you have a much better chance of getting pregnant when you freeze your eggs. You have a 40% chance. And he sort of drew this squiggly graph on like a scrap of paper on his desk. And then said, and I was like thinking, huh, okay, well, the way it's sold makes it seem like you're guaranteed to get pregnant if you freeze your eggs, which isn't true. And then I thought, well, you know, 40% is better than 0%, and I could still get pregnant naturally if I don't, if I do it. So maybe it's better to just have this, like, maybe better to think of it like as like an insurance policy. But I realized I really wanted this kind of like instant solution. And I thought, you know, everything would be better once I did it. And then I realized that that might not actually be the case.
Dori, how did people in your life react when you talked about freezing your eggs?
Well, I didn't tell that many people when I was considering doing it because I felt ashamed, I think. Like, it was almost like this admission of failure. Like, I had failed to complete that level of the video game. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like,
totally.
I just, so I didn't really tell that many people. And the couple people I told were like, oh, you don't need to do that. And I was like, what does that mean? I don't know what that means. And then, you know, a couple other people were supportive and just said, oh, you know, that sounds like, if that's what you want to do, you should do it. But I think everyone was also shocked at how expensive it was and how it wasn't like a guaranteed thing. I think that's the big misconception people have about egg freezing. It's like, if you freeze your egg, then you'll be fine. You'll be able to get pregnant later. And that's not true.
Yeah, I can't decide if I think there should be more or less discussion of it, you know, because mm-hmm. usually more information is good, but then it sort of makes people anxious. Like,
mm-hmm.
I actually reported that story that was never run, for a women's magazine a few years ago about sort of like how there was no right time to have a baby, and ended up talking to women in their 20s who were freezing their eggs. And I thought it was sort of insane. But then all the like gynecologists that I talked to were like, well, I don't know. It's, if you know, you're not going to get, it was just, there was so much weird emotion around it. And then the science is like, can be either read as alarmist or not. I don't know. There's just, there's both a lot of conversation about it, but not a lot of really honest conversation about it.
Yeah, you know, I talked about it with, one of the people I talked about it with was my gynecologist, who was actually very skeptical. She was like, be careful about who you go to. A lot of, like, you know, some places will just want to take, basically she was saying some places will just want to take your money.
Mm-hmm.
And be careful, like, what clinic you go to. And, you know, you don't have to do it. She herself had gotten pregnant in her late 30s and then again, I think, in her early 40s and was like, eh, you know, like, kind of like, look at me,
mm-hmm.
And was like, if you really want to do it, but just, you know, think about it. It's expensive. It's not, you know, it's not a sure thing. So that was interesting because I thought she was going to be like, yes, that is a wonderful idea that I want all of my patients to pursue. Mm-hmm. And she was not super gung-ho about it.
And Dori, what kind of response have you received about the piece? And maybe what has been most surprising to you about the responses you've gotten?
So I've definitely gotten more responses to this piece than anything I've ever written. And I've written a few personal pieces before, but this has just been completely overwhelming. Like emails, Facebook, Twitter, just so many women reaching out to me and saying either, like, I thought about freezing my eggs and I didn't for a lot of the reasons you articulated. Women saying, I'm in my early 30s and these are things that I'm starting to think about, and thank you for articulating them. I've heard from some men who have said, this is actually super interesting, men who said, you know, these are things that men think about too and no one talks about it. And I actually heard from a couple of women who said things to the effect of, you know, I got pregnant when I was 38 and I got pregnant when I was 41, and, you know, kind of the reassuring version of the email. So the response to me personally has been really nice.
With a couple of years distance and now 3,000 miles between you and New York, can you sort of sit judgment on your 35-year-old self? Do you have any regrets that, spoiler alert, you actually didn't go through with it in the end?
That is the spoiler. I try not to judge my past self too harshly. I think it was just a super anxious time for me, and I was kind of grasping at grasping for a solution, and it seemed like science with a capital S going to save me. And that just seemed really, really appealing. But, you know, I also think now, like you said, with a little bit of distance, and I definitely allude to this in the piece a lot, that New York has become super stressful for me. And I think leaving New York turned out to be one of the things that has calmed me.
That's wonderful. Dori, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Awesome. All right, let's move on to recommendations. Jessica, what do you have?
I want to recommend a novel by Megan Abbott called The Fever. It's gotten a fair bit of attention, including a very nice review in the New York Times, so people might already know about it. But in case you don't, I don't want to say too much about it because I knew nothing about it when I started reading it, and I think that's the best way to come to it. But just very briefly, it's about this mysterious seizure disorder that is possibly contagious, that strikes the girls and young women of a high school. And it's really just a completely addictive read. I read it really, really quickly. I could not wait to get to the end. And one of the reasons I want people to read it is I'm not sure how I feel about the ending, how I feel about the resolution. So I want to talk it out or argue about it with people. And no one I know has read the book, so please read the book. Again, it's called The Fever by Megan Abbott, and it's awesome.
I'm going to recommend two shows that air back-to-back on PBS starting this Sunday. Vicious, which stars Ian McKellen and Derek Jacobi as two men who've been together as a couple for 49 years, and they are vicious old queens, and that's the great thing about it. It also stars Frances de la Tour, who is just one of the great actresses of her generation or any generation, and who I think hasn't really gotten the credit she deserves. And she, weirdly enough, is almost reprising in a way a role that she played 40 years ago now in the 1970s in Rising Damp, a British soap opera. This show was created by an American, Gary Jannetty, who also created Will and Grace. And so it's just amazing that he could make such a British show that's very funny. And it is paired on PBS with Last Tango in Halifax, which also stars Derek Jacobi and is theoretically about a pair of 70 people in their 70s who get together after kind of losing touch for many years. So Derek Jacobi and Anne Reed. But my favorite bit is the relationship between Anne Reed's character's daughter, Caroline, played by the magnificent Sarah Lancashire, and Nina Sesanya. And I just think it's a great British show. And it's also a really wonderful romance. Romance on television is often larded up with other stuff. But Last Tango in Halifax is just a really sweet and funny and addictive romance.
What was the Jacobi and McKellen show called?
Vicious.
Because those two actors are two of the great King Lears of our time.
Indeed.
Oh, really?
Two of the monumental Lears. So to see them cast as a couple is just going to blow me away.
Well, and you know, they were at Cambridge together, although
I didn't know that.
Yeah. They've known each other a long time. And of course, you know, one of the great things about it, they're both out gay men. But this is their first sitcom. And it's really funny that Ian McKellen plays a sort of a jobbing actor who really doesn't get much work and has never had much work. Like, he's, you know, auditioning for a part to play a guy who walks on and mentions the potatoes in Downton Abbey. And it's just like the contrast between the real Sir Ian McKellen and Freddie, the character, is wonderful. Noreen, what do you have for us?
Well, mine is less highbrow and does not involve Shakespearean actors. I am going to recommend smearing random things in your kitchen on your face.
A what?
Beauty regime.
What?
I'm really excited to hear about this.
Well, so I don't even know how to go about talking about this one. I have sensitive skin and had a couple like sort of bad reactions to things this winter, and so have like not really touched my face with, you know, anything chemical in a while. But I have recently started, you know, as I'm sure many listeners do, like exploring the homeopathic beauty world a little bit, and have just started putting on like honey masks and olive oil masks, as you know, these are like old wives things, avocado masks, yogurt masks, oatmeal masks. I know I sound a bit crazed right now, but it's just really fun. Like, I don't think it's doing anything necessarily good for my skin. It's not doing anything bad for my skin, which right. is basically what I want. But it's just really fun to be like, today I'm going to put an avocado on my face and see how that goes. Today I'm going to squeeze a lemon and mix it with some honey and maybe oatmeal, and I could eat it or I could put it on my face and it doesn't really matter. So just the joy of playing around with face masks, which is like a thing you do as like a little kid, kind of. I remember, you know, when you're little and you want to sort of like play beauty parlor, I think my mom showed us how to make oatmeal masks. And I don't think I'd done it since then because, you know, I buy all the things that, you know, the beauty industry tells you to buy. But this is just really like, it really feels playful and fun. And if you are bored at home on like a Tuesday night, put some yogurt on your face and mix it up with a lemon and see how that goes. See if it
plain yogurt or flavored yogurt.
Well,
don't use the cherries from the side.
So basically, you basically want everything to be like as pure as possible.
Okay.
You know, like, so if you put olive oil on your face, don't use like the shitty olive oil that you might use to cook. Like, try to use the nicer stuff. Same thing, you know. So what I have used, which the internet tells me is fine. I mean, basically, I'm just Googling. I'm not an expert. I'm just like Googling things and seeing if people say it made them break out. And if they say no, I'm like, all right, I'll put it on my face. But I've put some Faye 2% on my face. Mm-hmm. It feels really good, too. I mean, again, like, don't think that's doing anything good for my skin, but it's really fun.
The thing that's funny is, Ellie, you were telling us that you don't have air conditioning. And so the idea of, like, being in a New York apartment in the humidity is one thing. But then doing that with Faye on your head, on your face?
I have an elaborate fan system going on.
All right, good. All right. Thanks to Chris Wade for recording and producing today's podcast. Many thanks to our intern, Laura Smith, and to Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. Remember to send your comments to xxgabfest@slate.com. For Jessica Winter and Noreen Malone, I'm June Thomas. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time, possibly wearing face masks.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.